came from a car ride back to the airport from our last conference. Some theologues in position were riding together, and somehow got on the topic of oral sex. I haven't asked them how they got on that topic, but nevertheless, they were discussing it, suggested it's often a common question of morality, and now it's also a question medically, since we've really seen an epidemic of herpes type 2 over the past 15 years or so. So today we have this distinguished panel up here. I'm simply a moderator. I'm not presenting any information. We've had vigorous discussion today, and I think that will continue. Dr. Hicks is going to start off and talk about some of the medical aspects of herpes. In his experience, he's watched it go from a curious phenomenon to one that's literally an epidemic. And then after that, Dr. Davis will give us a theological perspective, and then we'll let Pastor McConnell comment if he would like, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, Lewis, if you would start us off.
I was the guy that asked the question that resulted in my coming from out there to up here, so you better be careful about the questions you ask. I'd like to ask you, how many people in the audience have ever been bothered by a cold sore? Okay, thank you. I'm going to paint the medical picture of herpes of the genitalia. I'd like for you to think of them, of what I say, not just as facts, but as consequences of human behavior. We'll start with the word herpes. That's a Greek word meaning to creep. Originally used to define an animal that goes on all fours, a herpeton, natural study of reptiles. In the herpes, human herpes group, we have varicella zoster, which is a chickenpox virus, the cytomegalovirus, CMV, the Epstein-Barr virus, which causes mono, and then more pertinent to what we're going to be considering today are the genital herpes viruses, herpes simplex type 1, herpes simplex type 2. Now, of those two viruses, generally we see about 15% of genital herpes is type 1, and 85% is type 2. That is important in terms of the pathogenesis of the particular disease, in that type 2 has more devastating effects on the baby should the baby contract herpes as it passes through the vaginal canal. I'm going to get this straight in a minute. When I was about 18 months in my OBGYN residency at a major university hospital, I saw the first case of genital herpes. It was such a rare occasion in 1968 that we literally called all the students that were on the OBGYN service, all the residents from every part of the hospital, nurses are chuckling. We called them from everywhere to come and see this one lady's bottom because we might not get to see this again for a long while. I was drafted and sent to Vietnam, actually gone out of the residency for about 3 years from 68 to 71. While in Vietnam, I realized that there were some different things going on in terms of sexual activities, and that oral sex was becoming a very commonplace, whereas before it had not been. It was pretty much relegated to the lower socioeconomic group. And I realized that we were seeing quite a change in attitude about that, among other things. With this particular slide, you can see that back in before 1966, if you look at the green colors on the slide, that represents the genital herpes in the United States at that time, 66 to 72. The blue then from 73 to 78, and of course the red is more current. So at the present time, we still have about 300,000 new cases of genital herpes per year. It complicates 1% of all pregnancies. And of course, we take measures to inspect, etc., before we deliver babies to try to ascertain whether or not someone who has a history of genital herpes actually is shedding the virus at that particular time. Even taking these kinds of precautions, we still have one baby in about 2,000 to 5,000 live births that develops neonatal herpes. Now, it makes a difference whether or not you're dealing with a primary infection versus a recurrent infection. A primary infection is one that occurs in someone who previously had no circulating antibodies to the herpes virus. And so if a baby passes through the birth canal of such a woman who is manifesting open lesions, then you can expect that 50% of those babies are going to have neonatal herpes. And if it's a baby that's born to someone who has a recurrent infection, it's down to about 4%, because mom has circulating antibodies, they have crossed the placenta, and they help to protect the baby as well. So what happens to these babies if they, in fact, develop neonatal herpes? 40% of them will develop skin, eye, mouth disease. Rarely do any of those babies actually die, but 30% of them have some neurologic impairment. 35% of these babies develop encephalitis. Historically, 75% of those died, but with new systemic antiviral therapy, acyclovir, 15%, it's down to 15% mortality, but you have a majority of these infants with that are neurologically impaired. 25% of the time, the disease is actually disseminated. Most often, premature infants are afflicted. 90% of these babies have died historically, but with the systemic antiviral therapy, we're down to 65% of them dying from 90%. But you're left with 95% of those babies having major psychomotor retardation and blindness. So this conversation in the taxi to the airport, we were discussing the influence of oral sex on this epidemic. And quite frankly, I think it's something that has been overlooked in the literature. Often you'll hear mention or see mention in the literature of the 15% of genital herpes that's related to type 1 herpes, as if that were the only contribution of oral sex. For some reason, after seeing that first lady, I always ask every single patient I ever saw after that whether or not she practiced oral sex when I saw someone with genital herpes. I've only had three people in all my years since 1968 that said no. In other words, all the rest of them readily admitted that they were practicing oral sex. That's a good transport medium. Obviously, they can get herpes type 2 in the mouth, and they can get herpes type 1 on the genitalia. One would assume that if you have either type 1 or type 2 in the mouth, perhaps you kiss more people than you have intercourse with, and so you spread it that way, and then those people, if they practice oral sex, then it is spread even further. I don't know if you noticed, but on one of the earlier slides, you notice that women have a higher incidence of herpes genitalis than men do. I'm not sure what the implication is there in terms of oral sex, but there may be one. So at this point, I'm going to just stop with that much information, and I think Jack is going to give us some theological and other reflections on this whole process.
As I was coming down from Washington, D.C. this morning, on the plane I happened to notice in the second section of the Washington Post the headline concerning the conviction of a 28-year-old man in Maryland. This was in today's Washington Post. Under a law, a 74-year-old law in the state of Maryland, prohibiting, quote, perverse and unnatural sexual practices, end of quote. And this came out of a very strange and bizarre incident in which several years ago now, this 28-year-old Maryland man knocked on the door of a total stranger. The woman opened the door, and there was more than conversation involved. They had intercourse with one another and oral sex, and there was a later argument. The man made some accusations against the woman, and then she made accusations against the man concerning that he was forcing her to do this, and it was a rape situation and so forth, and it came to the attention of the court. And a lower Maryland court upheld his conviction, which is the only time in the history of the state of Maryland in which anyone has come to trial under this law, which has been on the books for 74 years but has never been enforced. And I suspect that there are many other state laws of that sort. I also would expect that his conviction would be overturned on appeal, as it's now under appeal to the Maryland Supreme Court, arguments about privacy and so forth. Well, but I've been asked to make a few comments from the biblical and ethical perspective about this issue. And so I think it comes to us not only as a concern from our contemporary culture, one that certainly has pastoral ramifications, certainly one that has implications for our own Christian practice. So let me say what I say with something of a disclaimer. We have to deal with some rather perhaps unpleasant and perhaps graphic sexual practices here, so I hope you'll forgive me if this is perhaps somewhat offensive, but this is my assignment here to try to reflect on the issue of oral sex from the history of Scripture and church history. So I want to make some comments, first of all, relating to certain texts in the New Testament. And then secondly, I want to make some remarks based on rabbinic discussions of this or related issues in the Talmud, which may also help us to understand certain statements that Paul makes or does not make in his writings. As we know, Paul, of course, was schooled in rabbinic Judaism. And then thirdly, I want to comment on some of the comments that have been made on related issues, that is, of sexual practices within marriage, within the Roman Catholic tradition, especially within conservative pre-Vatican II Catholicism, and then give you my own conclusion. Now, I think as we all realize, such specific sexual practices are not directly described or discussed within the Bible, so at best we're dealing with inferences or deductions as we try to ask the question, well, does the Bible have anything to say at all whatsoever about the appropriateness or non-appropriateness of certain sexual practices, say, within Christian marriage? Let's forget about the world here, but concern ourselves with what might be appropriate or not appropriate within Christian marriage. Now, I would draw to your attention one statement made by the Apostle Paul in the fourth chapter of the book of Ephesians, where he's discussing the contrast between the lifestyle of the Gentiles and the lifestyle of Christians. He says, this is Ephesians 4, 17 and following, "You must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking, in the darkening of their mind," and so forth. And then in verse 19, he makes the comment, "having lost all sensitivity," that is, moral and spiritual sensitivity to God and to divine things, "they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity," now there's an interesting word, "with a continual lust for more." All right, now the word in the Greek New Testament is akatharsia. What does that mean? You know, what does Paul mean when he talks about impurity or uncleanness in reference to the sexual practices of the Gentiles? Well, the fact of the matter is that Paul does not define exactly what he means by uncleanness. If you do a word study of the concept of uncleanness or impurity, the word used by Paul here in Ephesians 4, sometimes it has a ritual connotation of contact with a dead body. In other contexts, it can mean persons who are possessed by demons and are spiritually and ritually unclean in that sense. And also in many other instances, it refers to a type of moral defilement or impurity, which oftentimes is associated in these New Testament texts with fornication, or with adultery, or with other sexual practices which are not clearly defined. So my first observation would be that while things such as fornication, premarital sex, adultery, homosexuality, bestiality, and so forth, are clearly sinful practices, and I think can be shown to be so, based on the New Testament evidence, it's not so clear at all whether or not Paul would have understood something like oral sex as being the type of lustful impurity and immoral practice that so characterized the Gentile world. Well, can we get any light on what Paul might have understood when he was writing to the Ephesians to avoid a lot of these immoral Gentile practices by raising the question, well, in rabbinic Judaism, do we have specific commentary on what sexual practices within marriage are considered appropriate or less appropriate? Well, in one tractate of the Talmud, as you know, is the rabbinic commentary and discussion on the 613 specific commandments of the Torah, finally compiled around the year 600 or 700 A.D., discussing almost every conceivable aspect of human experience, including human sexuality within marriage. According to one discussion in the tractate Nidah, Laws Concerning the Menstruating Woman, there's a very outspoken opinion on masturbation, for example. One rabbi said that those who masturbate ought to have their hands cut off. Another rabbi said, quote, "whoever emits semen in vain deserves death." See, the only lawful use of the male semen was for a procreative purpose. And so someone who, for example, through coitus interruptus or through masturbation, wasted male semen in a non-procreative fashion was guilty of serious sin. should have their hands cut off. So they had a very dim view of that, and in my view, an excessively rigorous view. The rabbis also were very modest in terms of sexual practices. According to one rabbi here, Nitta 17a, the Holy One, blessed be He, hates the man who has intercourse in the presence of any living creature, not only any other living person, but any living animal, including an insect. One rabbi chased away the mosquitoes from his bed before having marital relations with his wife. That was an offense against modesty. Well, again, you find interesting discussions. Now, some of this may seem a little bit arcane to you, but again, we're trying to understand the world and mind of the Apostle Paul. This is the world in which he was schooled, in which he was trained. He was, of course, as you know, a student of Rabbi Gamaliel I. Tractate Netarim 20a, again from the Talmud, again has some very specific comments about what conservative rabbis in the first century A.D. and later might well have thought about certain sexual practices. Rabbi Josiah says, "He who gazes at a woman eventually comes to sin, and he who looks even at a woman's heel will beget degenerate children." Rabbi Joseph says this applies even to one's own wife when she's in her menstrual period. Rabbi Lachish said, "Heel is stated to mean the unclean part, which is directly opposite the heel." Now, evidently that's a rabbinic euphemism, so that perhaps even if you gaze at your wife's genitals, okay, that's immodesty, and it might cause you to have children who have some birth defect. Rabbi Johanan Dehabai said, "The ministering angels told me four things. People are born lame because their parents overturned their table, i.e. practiced unnatural cohabitation." In other words, this is probably, again, a rabbinic euphemism for anal intercourse. So according to one rabbinic opinion here, engaging in anal intercourse within marriage might cause you to have children with a birth defect. Another rabbi says here that kissing that place, I think that's an implicit reference to oral sex, was not considered to be appropriate. Now, however, as you go on and read this particular discussion, and this is, I think, in the Talmud, the most detailed discussion that I've been able to find here, that was the minority view. The minority view is stated later in that chapter, but our sages say, quote, and here it comes, and this is, represents a rather male-oriented chauvinistic perspective, a man may do whatever he pleases with his wife, that is, during intercourse. And cases discussed here, a woman once came and asked the rabbi, "Rabbi, I set a table before my husband, but he overturned it." See, apparently the husband was insisting on rectal intercourse, okay, and the woman found this offensive. The rabbi replied, "My daughter, the Torah hath permitted thee to him. What can I do for thee?" So according to the majority view here in Pharisaic Judaism, there were nothing morally inappropriate as far as the rabbi concerned with sexual practices such as oral sex or even rectal intercourse. Now, that is how I read the rabbinic material. So what I'm saying here is that if you look at Ephesians 4, in certain of the Pauline statements concerning marital relationships, I don't find any compelling evidence that Paul might have considered certain practices inherently sinful. All right, now, it's another matter entirely, as to whether or not there are medical facts out there that would make certain practices perhaps foolish under present circumstances. Well, now, what about conservative Roman Catholic theology? Now, you'll find again in the Summa Theologica of Thomas Aquinas a discussion about the meaning of the word lust. We know that lust is the moral equivalent of adultery according to Jesus Christ. So then the discussion comes, well, what constitutes lust? And is it possible for a believer to commit lust even within marriage? All right, now we have a discussion of the meaning of lust in certain unnatural sexual practices by Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologica, Part 2-2, Question 154. And he says, "I answer that whenever there occurs a special kind of deformity whereby the sexual act is rendered unbecoming, there is a species of lust. What are his examples that he considers lust? Number one, by procuring pollution without any copulation for the sake of pleasure. St. Thomas Aquinas and all conservative pre-Vatican II Catholic moralists have considered masturbation for any purpose to be gravely sinful. So you can trace that all the way back to Thomas Aquinas. Second example, number one, masturbation. Number two, bestiality, intercourse with an animal. Thirdly, copulation with an undue sex, sodomy or homosexual intercourse. And then his fourth example, which he would consider to be lust. Fourthly, by not observing the natural manner of copulation, either as to undue means or as to, quote, other monstrous and bestial manners of copulation. What does he mean by that? Now, he doesn't really define his terms, but I would take that to mean that, in Thomas Aquinas' opinion, certain forms of fetishism and probably sadomasochistic practices within marriage, okay, would be considered monstrous or unnatural sexual practices within marriage, and with that I would agree. Now, he doesn't directly talk about the issue of oral sex. All right, now coming down to the Second Vatican Council here, or actually before, there are many morals of or handbooks of Roman Catholic moral theology in which the Roman Catholic moralists try to give priests, this was before Vatican II, very detailed and specific information about how they should relate to various things which the parishioner might confess in the confessional booth. And some of these, of course, relate to sexual practices. For example, the Handbook of Moral Theology by Dominic Prumer, a Dominican, talks about, quote, the circumstances of the conjugal act. Quote, not only the conjugal act itself, but also touches and looks, and all other acts are lawful between the married, provided there is no proximate danger of pollution and the sole intention is not mere sexual pleasure. Therefore, he says, in ordinary circumstances, the priest should not interrogate married persons about these other acts. What's he saying? What's he saying there, the implication there, is that a very conservative pre-Vatican II Roman Catholic ethicist would not consider oral sex per se to be sinful or inappropriate. But again, he continues the tradition going all the way back to Thomas Aquinas and perhaps even before, that any type of spilling of the semen that can have no procreative effect is gravely sinful. So mutual masturbation, for example, would be problematic according to this point of view. All right, now, so it's rather interesting that some of the most conservative rabbinic sources and also some of the most conservative Roman Catholic moralists would not say that per se that these practices are necessarily simple. Well, what about 20th century evangelical sexologists such as Ed Wheat and his widely read sex manual, Evangelical Sex Manual, Intended for Pleasure? All right. According to Ed Wheat, page 76, oral sex, quote, is a matter which concerns only the husband and wife involved. If both of you enjoy it and find it pleasant, then it may properly fit into your love-making practices. If either partner has any hesitation about it, however, it will add little pleasure to the relationship and should be continued. All right, so that's Ed Wheat's view. He responds to a further question on page 194 and adds a little caveat. He says, it's come to my attention on many occasions that couples early in their marriage have been unable to achieve sufficient stimulation for the wife. Very often this is because the husband has been unable to control himself, etc. As a solution, they turn to oral sex in order to bring her to orgasm, and this becomes, in a sense, a shortcut, avoiding the development of the discipline and self-control that is demanded in learning how to consistently provide maximum pleasure for both through ordinary intercourse. And so we suggest that under certain circumstances, if this becomes a substitute, okay, then this might hinder the unity and the oneness that God has designed for the husband and wife. Okay, an interesting observation. But Wheat's opinion would appear to be sort of the dominant 20th century evangelical view. All right, now, what's my bottom line conclusion here? I don't find any clear teaching, okay, from the Scriptures from the New Testament that convinces me that this practice would be inherently immoral or sinful. Okay, but like any other sinful or any other sexual practice here, it could conceivably become morally problematic. You know, if it were practiced in an inordinate or obsessive way, that can be true of almost any sexual practice. And furthermore, I think in today's world, we certainly need to be aware of the possible medical complications might also be attended with such practices.
I'll make a pastoral comment on that, not on Dr. Davis's comments, but on the practice of oral sex. I've been over 11 years in the same pastor, and
of all the questions that get asked of me by married couples, the one concerning oral sex is the question that gets asked the most frequently. It does not get asked every month of the year. I'm not talking about that kind of frequency, but out of all the questions that I've had from married couples about their sexual relationship, the one about oral sex seems to be the one that concerns them the most. Until I'm the taxi that took Hicks and Davis back to the airport last year in Atlanta, and until Lewis said something in the car, and I don't know how the conversation came up, but until he said something, my policy has always been, and in fact it still is, as of this moment, to say to a married couple, if you both consent to it, I see no reason why you can't do it. I've never been able to find anything in the scriptures that militates against it. I have had several situations where the husband forced it on the wife and she objected strongly, and that is a very volatile situation for a pastor to be involved in. I don't like it at all, but I've been involved in it a few times. I take a very low-key approach, and I am not low-key by nature, but I am with that kind of situation. And, of course, where the wife is being forced, I don't think it's right at all. Now, I really don't know what I'm going to do with the information that Dr. Hicks has presented, but I've done a lot of thinking about it since Atlanta, and perhaps some further information will come to light that will give all of us direction.
Might ask Dr. Davis, in light of what Dr. Hicks has said, how whether he would consider that the possibility, maybe even probability, that herpes might be passed on not only to the spouse, but in the case of the woman, to the child as well, whether that would be necessarily a prohibition against the practice of oral sex.
Okay, the comments that I made were just sort of addressing this issue, I think, somewhat in separation and even in abstraction from the medical realities that today, in 1990 in the United States, you have to face up to. So I think when you look at the bigger picture and just say, all right, now having searched the scriptures here and come to a certain opinion here, I think to be morally responsible, the total moral judgment has to take in light the concrete empirical reality. So that, for example, if you had a situation where the man or the woman here knew that they were infected, okay, for example, and failed to disclose that information to their husband or wife, then you're certainly dealing with a moral issue there. It would also certainly be very unethical to inflict your infection on your husband, your wife, or any of your children yet to be born here. So, I mean, that's a clear moral issue there. And here again, you're asking too about, well, what's one's degree of knowledge here? And I would say that given the long-term possible consequences here, we should ask, in premarital counseling, in dating and marriage process, some questions that might not have been necessary to ask a generation or two generations ago. But this is the world in which we live, and we cannot simply assume that simply because we are Christians marrying a Christian, perhaps, that sexually transmitted diseases are not an issue that will touch our relationship.
Before I open it up to the audience, I'm going to ask if Charles or Lewis has additional comments.
Well, you'll recall that I asked people to raise their hand if they'd ever had a cold sore. Well, presumably that cold sore is herpes type 1, presumably. At least it's herpes 1 or 2. So we saw that the majority of our audience here today is apparently carrying that virus. And so if they engage in anal sex, there's every possibility that genital herpes could develop, and then we could have all the consequences we've talked about neonatal herpes and so forth. So the wages of sin is still death, and whenever I see death, I have to ask, are we doing something that directly leads to that death? In this particular instance, possibly.
Think of the the Pauline statement that he quotes somewhere in 1 Corinthians. You know, he's probably quoting a statement made there in Corinth. You know, all things are lawful. But then Paul says, all things may be lawful, but not all things are prudent or expedient. So this may be an area where that might have some relevance as well.
You know, we're also getting to the thing in Leviticus about man having sex with his wife while she's on her period. And there are a couple of things that we're now learning about that that sheds a little... makes things interesting. I mean, I think we sort of snickered about that kind of law in the past, but there's a theory that one of the causes of endometriosis, which is a primary cause of infertility in this country, may be having intercourse while the woman is on her period. And the force of that, actually forcing blood out through the tubes and dripping down into the pelvis and causing a problem with endometriosis, and also, of course, infection. The woman has mucus in the cervix, which protects her from bacteria ascending the reproductive tract except during her menses, and then she's defenseless. The blood has washed out that mucus, and as you all know, blood is an excellent culture medium. It's what we use so often as a culture plate, and so bacteria that otherwise would have been benign in her vagina now become threatening. 95% of all urinary tract infections in women will be E. coli, her own E. coli from her own rectum, which are brought into the bladder at the time of intercourse. Those same bacteria then are taken into the vagina during the sexual act and can zoom right up into the cervix, and especially in those women who wear tampons, because anytime you stop up a system, any kind of the vagina was meant to be open and to flow readily, so you get this dose of bacteria, if you will, into the vagina, then stop it up with a tampon, and you're sitting on a real bad situation. I've seen quite a few women with what we call PID, and you can trace it to that kind of situation.
Yes. Could you direct your questions to one of the panel, or just say anybody?
Man, male, female, and sexual act,
Okay, the question is, could we just sort of appeal to God's natural creative design of the male and female bodies in relation to the question of the ethics of oral sex? It's a good question. My initial comment would be that I think you have a pretty strong argument against homosexual intercourse on those grounds, in that obviously in such cases here, and this is sort of the type of natural law Roman Catholic argument here, which argues not only against, or could argue against, such practices, but against, of course, any form of contraception, different issue entirely. But it seems to me you have a stronger argument there against homosexuality than against certain practices that are not procreative in nature, but presumably would enhance the pleasure of the process within married love. And since that type of pleasure is proper to married love, don't see any tremendous problems there. I think Ed Wheat's observation, however, that is good, in that to not totally separate the aspects of pleasure from the unitive aspect of marriage, which sexual intercourse is designed to enhance. Okay, the two shall become one flesh. So one could argue, I guess, that any type of practice here which doesn't naturally enhance or lead toward the one flesh unity might be, you know, getting a little bit out of balance, or not placing the emphasis where it ought to be taken.
So, Jack, I'd like to ask you, with the reasoning that you had earlier from rabbinic law, are you saying that not only oral sex in marriage, but anal sex would be acceptable to the authors here?
First of all, let me carefully distinguish some of the views that I've cited from my own view. Okay, I think that the issue of, you know, anal sex versus oral sex, that's a step beyond probably both medically and possibly ethically itself, because I think rectal intercourse does raise the issue of sodomy and the design of the natural order and so forth in a way in which the other practices don't. And but to answer your question, I think the rabbis, or at least the majority view in the Talmud, did not see that as problematic. Now, I think that the way the texts are written, it represents very much a male viewpoint, and not the type of mutual type of viewpoint that I see Paul expressing in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 through 8, which is the most direct, I think, discussion anywhere in the New Testament about sexual intercourse within marriage, and where it's very clear that Paul has a view of mutuality there, should be mutual consent and so forth. You don't find that in the Talmud. So I find it very striking here that Paul, the former rabbi, has a view of Christian marriage in general, and also sexual intercourse within marriage, which is much more sensitive, I think, to the feelings of women. And mutuality then was the case in the first century and later rabbinic Judaism. So I think I would have more reservations, frankly, about implications of that, or possible problems.
Well, obviously, oh yeah, we've got real problems with that from a medical point of view, in that obviously you're going to get infections in the male that are going to threaten his fertility, and then he's also going to infect the female, and again with especially if obviously if he goes from the rectum to the vagina during the time she's on her period, that could be life threatening. So that's a real problem. In doing speaking to people about, I was on a sex education panel for the public schools, and as we already heard today, that's a nightmare. But the point that I would make to them was that we had a chaste man that married a chaste woman, that if they were faithful to one another, they could practice sexual intercourse endlessly, exclusive of oral or anal sex and never, ever expect to have a sexually transmitted disease. And I think that's a true statement. But if you introduce anal or oral sex, then obviously, even within marriage, you can have a perfectly faithful couple, monogamous couple, who then can contract at least herpes and probably also PID if they include oral anal sex in their equation. So I think that's telling.
Another question, a fact that might come up is, you know, well, how common in American society are such practices? Well, that's
very,
very maybe not easy to quantify, but again, according to the article in this morning's Washington Post, the Psychological Association of the State of Maryland claims, and that's all I can say, it's a claim, that 90% of heterosexual couples in the United States practice oral sex. Now, I don't know what credence to give that figure. I'd give you some ballpark figure. That those statistics may be geared with a view to the overturning before the Maryland Supreme Court of the existing laws banning such practices, but whatever, that's for what it's worth. That's one figure that I've seen very recently.
Question, is that Hilton back there? Yeah, okay.
they brought it up, by the way. I don't know.
Well, I have. I had to deal with that, and of course.
Repeat the question.
I'm sorry. Have I had to deal with couples where the wife has developed herpes genitalis, and the claim is that they have been perfectly faithful to one another? And yes, I have dealt with that, and of course, I think we've already alluded to certainly a possible way for that to occur, and it's through oral sex, and as I said before, when I question these couples, almost always they have said yes, I practice oral sex and just did the other day, and you can trace it back to that. So I think that's how it's happening in a monogamous situation. Yes, ma'am. Yes, we know that, I mean, generally we think of the cold sore as herpes type 1. And we know that of all cases of genital herpes, at least 15% of those cases are of the type 1 virus. Unfortunately, practicing physicians today do not have available to them techniques that reliably tell them whether they're dealing with type 1 or type 2. Many hospitals and laboratories will report out the virus as type 1 or type 2, but in fact, their reagents really don't allow them to. This is probably erroneous information that we're getting back. But in investigative studies where they've been using good laboratory techniques, it runs about 15% of the time you culture out type 1 in the herpes genitalis. That is not as serious to the baby as the type 2, but it can still cause all the things that we've talked about before, including death, so it can be serious. Yes, ma'am. Oh, he's probably kissing, you know, probably kissing. As you saw, most people here today have cold sores.
Okay, let me comment briefly. Romans 14:23, whatever is not of faith is sin. Okay, I would say that the implication here would be that if either partner, within Christian marriage has reservations about this and cannot engage in a certain practice with good conscience, for them it is sinful, you shouldn't do it. So here again, I think that would reinforce the principle of mutuality within marriage that Paul otherwise articulates in 1 Corinthians 7. Just let me briefly allude to an article that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, I believe it was, Sexual Behavior of College Women in 1975, 1986, and 1989. Bottom line of a survey based on the behavior of women at a certain well-known Eastern university, I think it was Brown University, shows that in spite of the AIDS epidemic, knowledge of sexually transmitted diseases, sexual promiscuity among college students and engaging in a wide variety of sexual practices basically has unchanged, okay? And so I think the implication might be that, well, if a young person then comes to faith in Christ, enters into a Christian marriage, we obviously have a pre-Christian past to deal with. So I think certainly as pastors, counselors, parents, that raises some other considerations as we talk to younger people about the whole issue of extramarital and premarital sex.
Also in the New England Journal of Medicine, 1989, a study on the incidence of herpes type 2 in the population in general, but under the age of 15, only 1% positive. Between 30 and 44, 20.2%. And then there's significant difference in the prevalence in race, 19.7% in whites in general, 64.7% in blacks. So somebody was asking about early in life about the herpes virus, and you see that only 1% under the age of 15 for the type 2 virus.
Dean?
Yeah, that's what you do. 4 or 5 years ago, we were trying to culture all these people, and of course, the turnaround time on the culture is several days, and also the cultures go for about $60 to $80 each, and it was prohibitive, but at this point, we simply question them during the prenatal course whether or not they've had it, and if they say yes, then make them aware that if they have any lesions at the time of delivery, it's an automatic cesarean section, and of course, if they develop the primary infection at that time, for sure you're going to do a cesarean. And then the question comes in about ruptured membrane. Sometimes the patient has active herpes. She ruptures her membranes, and she lives some distance from the hospital. So there used to be, we used to work on a four-hour window type thing. In other words, if she was 4 hours later and getting to the hospital, you just let her deliver vaginally. But we have learned that even in those instances, we're going to have less neonatal herpes if we go ahead and do a cesarean section. So have quite a few cesareans. That has contributed, by the way, to the increase in cesarean sections. And obviously you don't get rid of the herpes, so you continue to, you know, that continues to be a problem. Right. In general, that's correct. But also, there's a time about 24 hours before the lesion actually erupts that they shed virus. And so they're oftentimes not aware of it. That's right. That's right. And 80% of the babies that come down with neonatal herpes, the mother wasn't aware that she had herpes at all. And so you've got that problem too.
Other questions? Over here. What's your question specifically?
Where is the morality of any of this? I see it as
I'm not sure that I understand the question. Let me make a comment and then allow you to respond. They're certainly not all conservative Bible-believing Christians are agreed on an issue which is really related but not the same as the one that we've tried to address here, namely the basic biblical or theological appropriateness or lack of appropriateness of artificial means of birth control within marriage. Okay, separate issue. There are some Christians, maybe you're one of them, who feel that all things considered, Christians ought not to use birth control within marriage. I take the other view. I've articulated that in my book, Evangelical Ethics. So I think we're dealing with two different issues here, and I think sort of a short, simple, but I think important argument in my mind is that, well, we're made in God's image and likeness, and we're called not only to subdue the earth, but also to replenish the earth. And if we're made in God's image and likeness, our way of creation should in some sense correspond and reflect His. Now, I think God creates according to a plan. God does not create simply as an afterthought or whatever, but God creates according to wisdom and according to knowledge and according to a plan. So I think if our procreation reflects God's creation, then that's one can, I think, argue for the legitimacy within marriage of family planning and birth control.
I also have a book back there that deals with the subject of Christians and birth control. And essentially, Dr. Davis and I agree. I think another way to look at it, there are two other ways to look at it. Number one is that if the sexual act only has to do with procreation, then every time you have a sexual act is not intended for procreation, and that's wrong. Also, there are married couples that for various physical reasons cannot have intercourse or cannot have children. That would make their sexual life illegitimate, and I just don't think you can take that absolute position.
The Roman Catholic tradition has tended, I think, to very strongly emphasize the procreative, you know, dimension of the marriage relationship, and that's clearly a biblical emphasis. I think sometimes in reaction, certain Protestants, certainly liberal Protestants, secularists, and even some evangelical Protestants have tended to react to that, sort of Roman Catholic, medieval, sacramental, whatever, view of marriage, and say, no, we want to stress the interpersonal dimension of it to enhance the relationship and so forth. So that's also a biblical strand, but I think a more balanced view would affirm both the procreative dimension, but also the interpersonal dimension of marriage. And so I think human sexuality within marriage should be related to, you know, in principle, not on necessarily at every particular action, but in principle, trying to hold those two aspects of married love together, which I think the Bible itself holds together. But if you say that every sexual or quasi-sexual act here must be directly procreative, then of course, you know, how does, you know, kissing your wife qualify there? Well, I mean, it's only, that in itself is not a procreative act, but it's certainly an act which is proper to marriage and should, you know, contribute directly to the interpersonal unity and certainly indirectly to procreation. Okay.
We're winding down here. You better get your questions in. All the way in the back.
I think we've all wound down.
Okay, I'm going to give you one more opportunity for the person that just has a burning question that they want to ask in public, in this public forum. And whenever you put it that way, everybody's always intimidated. Nobody asks. Oh, okay.